Now, detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come for America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapults to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
2015 could be the year that we discover that we are not alone in the universe. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Of course, we know that we're not alone in the universe. As Christians, we understand that there is a spirit realm that is populated with God, his angels, and of course, the disloyal angels who have rebelled against him. But according to a prominent attorney and ufologist who dropped a bombshell at the Contact in the Desert UFO conference this past weekend, Pope Francis is about to issue an encyclical that would confirm the existence of extraterrestrial life. This is no news or no surprise to our guest, who predicted this 2 years ago, as he is the co-author of the book with Tom Horn, Exo Vaticana, and the new book also, On the Path of the Immortals. He posted this prediction over 2 years ago at his blog, Logos Apologia. We welcome Chris Putnam back to the bunker. Chris, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, Derek. It's great to be back on Views from the Bunker with you.
Well, I was sorry we didn't have an opportunity to talk with you face-to-face here in this comfortable little studio while you were here for Skywatch TV and the Jim Baker show, but you had a lot of other things going on that weekend. And, of course, we discovered once you were also up here while Steve Quayle was in the Skywatch TV studio, and we discovered that the walls are not exactly soundproof between here and there. So rather than disrupt what was going on in there, we passed on the opportunity to talk face-to-face. But the announcement that came out of the UFO conference in the high desert of California this past weekend, it just really requires your insight, especially because you and Tom predicted this a couple of years ago, that Pope Francis would announce an extraterrestrial. Is savior a too strong a word?
Well, you know, according to some of the Catholic literature that we cite in the book, it's not.
This really seems like a bombshell. Now, of course, we're going on secondhand reports of people who were at the conference, and we don't have an opportunity to vet that this was exactly what Daniel Sheehan said, and we don't know where Daniel Sheehan is getting his information or whether he's reporting it accurately, for that matter. So we're making some guesses here as to whether this is him going freelance. Or if this is something that he is passing along. Now, I've only had the opportunity to do just a very little, just a little bit of background research on Dan Sheehan, but he seems to be pretty well connected. I mean, as an attorney, this is a guy who worked on the Silkwood case, which people might remember from the movie starring Meryl Streep. He also worked on the Pentagon Papers case. He was the legal counsel for the Library of Congress when they investigated. At the request of then-President Jimmy Carter, when the Library of Congress investigated evidence for the existence of extraterrestrials, Mr. Sheehan also set up public advocacy legal group in Washington after the Silkwood case. And one of his partners in this firm was a Jesuit priest. Now, of course, we know that Pope Francis is also a Jesuit. And that was part of the announcement that Sheehan made, that Pope Francis, according to the report that I read, wants to position the Vatican and the Jesuit order to accept and to pass along to humanity that we need to change our form of government and be prepared to change, I don't know, biologically in order to join an enlightened galactic civilization, organization. Does any of this surprise you?
It's not terribly surprising, and I, you know, like I said, we were expecting something like this. I don't know exactly what this is all about. Daniel Sheehan, you know, as you said, he's a Harvard College-trained, you know, attorney. He's tried many prominent, famous legal cases, so he's a serious person. He's not, you know, someone who's going to just go out and totally lie.
He's not Giorgio Tsoukalos.
You know, the thing that I'm concerned about is, you know, we are getting this secondhand. It's, you know, blogs about from people who went to the conference in the desert. What is it? What was it called? Contact in the Desert.
Right.
A UFO conference out in California, right? And he, according to secondhand reports, Sheehan, in his talk, announced that his belief that Pope Francis was going to reveal this on June 15th, which is actually my birthday. I found that a little weird. So I don't know what to do about that. But, you know, I don't know if that's true or not, because I wasn't there. But, you know, according to these, you know, reports on the Internet, he did say that. And, you know, I actually cited him in the book Exo Vaticana because he said similar things in the past. Like one of the things that I remember I cited him saying was that, you know, at the Vatican Astrobiology Conference in 2009, he talked about the astrobiologist, scientist, Dr. Chris Impey, who is at the University of Arizona. And she had said, you know, Dr. Impey said that we expect to announce something in a few short years. And that was an accurate quote. And Impey did say that. And what Impey was talking about really, I think, was the existence of, they were finding so many exoplanets, planets outside of our solar system, that they really kind of assumed within a few years that they would find one that had signs of life. And Impey did say that, and a lot of astrobiologists definitely believe that. So that was an accurate statement. And so, if he really said this, then he probably believes it to be true. I don't think that he's intentionally lying. Now, he might be somewhat of a sensationalist. You know, a lot of people that speak at UFO conferences are, and, you know, they tend to exaggerate the evidence a little bit from time to time. So, you know, I wouldn't be terribly shocked if he was, you know, elaborating on it a little bit more than what he actually knows. I don't know, though, you know, and it's not just that he knows a Jesuit. He was the lead counsel for the Jesuit order at one point. He was employed by the Jesuit order as their attorney. So that was his job for a while. And, you know, when he testified at the disclosure conference in Washington, D.C., you can find this on the Internet, his testimony. And in fact, I have that posted at my website. I think there's at Logos Apologia, there's a post that says where I was kind of confronting Guy Consolmagno, who kind of gave a little rebuttal to some of the things we said in our book. But Sheehan, I have a video there on the site where Sheehan is testifying, you know, before this congressional thing at the disclosure hearing, and he talks about Jimmy Carter requesting UFO files from the Vatican. And then Sheehan says, you know, as lead attorney for the Jesuits, I was the representative who contacted the Vatican Library and asked for these records. He says, they turned me down. Hmm. And then I contacted them back and said, hey, do you know who I am? I'm not, you know, I'm the lead counsel for the Jesuit order, and I'm asking this on the request of the President of the United States. Again, the Vatican Library turned him down. They said, no, you can't see anything that we have. And they didn't say we don't have anything. They said, no, you can't see it. So that was his testimony on that. And, you know, that's pretty sensational in and of itself, because it does sound like they're hiding something when they wouldn't even turn it over to Jimmy Carter. So, you know, he is intimately involved in the Jesuit order and has, you know, deep contacts within the Catholic Church. He's not a Catholic. So that's another reason I'm a little skeptical about him. I've seen some of the things he says. He's pretty much a New Age type guru in a lot of ways. He talks about chakras and elevating your consciousness to these higher levels and the same sort of Eastern spirituality that you hear coming from most New Agers and, you know, pantheists. So he does seem like a pantheist to me. Mm. And, you know, so I'm a little skeptical about any of his theological conclusions or anything like that, or that he might say about aliens. But, you know, does he have real connections with the Vatican? Yes, he does. Does he have real connections within the Jesuit order? Yeah, he very much does. He was their lead counsel for a number of years. So he is in a position to know something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the rumor on the Internet right now is that, you know, he said that Pope Francis is going to make an announcement on June 15th. You know, and what that announcement will be exactly, you know, I don't know. But I have some ideas that might be a lot more general than this rumor is giving us the impression of.
And I think rumor is the correct word, because, again, we're reading this secondhand from somebody who was at this conference, somebody who might have a vested interest in pushing a particular idea into the public consciousness. So we don't know from Mr. Sheehan if this is exactly what he said, or this is what was reported.
Right.
And it could be that the person who reported this
is wrong,
and perhaps
or mistaken. You know, they could just be mistaken.
Right. They may be conflating
a conspiracy,
because we do know, and I talked in fact with Tom Horn about this. This was part of a good deal of one of the interviews we posted at Skywatch TV about your new book, On the Path of the Immortals, the mm-hmm. forthcoming papal encyclical on climate change. So
right.
we do know that there's a papal encyclical planned on that. That is confirmed, and it's possible. Mm-hmm. that whoever was at this conference conflated a mention of that papal encyclical with the idea of ET disclosures, maybe conflating that with earlier releases from people like Guy Consolmagno or Jose
right.
Funes about...
Yeah, there's that telling.
Yeah, yeah. So that is a possibility, but I certainly wanted to get your impression, if this was accurately reported, what exactly this might mean. But if we were setting that aside, you know, even if we assume that this is rumor, what can you say about the role that the Vatican has played, and you know, through perhaps with perhaps the assistance of people like Daniel Sheehan in their interest in the possible existence of extraterrestrials?
Well, yeah, the Vatican has, you know, unambiguously made a lot of statements about the existence of extraterrestrial life. Pope Francis last year, you know, made some comments about baptizing Martians. You know, he actually used the term Martian. And of course, you know, the astronomers with the Vatican Observatory Research Group, acronym VORG, V-O-R-G, the VORG have been out in the media promoting the idea of baptizing ETs and the existence of ETs since 1993. When I researched Exo Vaticana, I tried to look back, you know, through old newspapers and everything I could find. The first mention I have of a Jesuit talking about baptizing an ET goes back to George Coignet in 93, right after the Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope on Mount Graham went online. And he gave an interview, and it's actually in the book Exo Vaticana as well, where he said, you know, the Vatican and NASA are teaming up to find the aliens and then see if they're ready to be baptized into the Catholic Church. And, you know, it almost sounded so ridiculous that I thought he was joking. But, I mean, it was a real newspaper article, and there was no indication that it was tongue-in-cheek. And some of the people around the Mount Graham area, the Indians who were protesting them being up there in the early 90s, took it so seriously, they contacted NASA. And NASA's representative blatantly denied that they had any connection with the Vatican in that endeavor. So NASA's not really involved in the Vatican Advanced Technology Telescope. That's really the University of Arizona and, you know, a consortium of other players. But, you know, I don't know why he said that stuff. I mean, but it was literally there, and that article is available, and it's footnoted in the book Exo Vaticana. But, you know, I suspect, this is my suspicion, if there is an announcement on the 15th, my suspicion is that it's going to be something along the lines of, it's okay for Catholics to believe in extraterrestrials. I don't think that he's going to give anything specific like, we have identified this species of aliens and, you know, we're in contact with them and blah, blah, blah. I don't think it's that. And that's the way this internet rumor is making it sound, like he's going to confirm the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life. I don't think it's that. I think it's more like, it's within, you know, the teaching of the Catholic Church to allow that God has created other beings, blah, blah, blah. I think it'll be something of that nature if it does come out. And they've been saying that for a long time anyway, but I don't guess a pope has ever directly addressed it. Now, Pope Francis, you know, along with being the first Jesuit pope, he is, you know, a scientist. His degree, his master's degree, I think, was in chemistry. So, you know, he started out as a young man wanting to be a scientist. So, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that he's intimately connected to the Jesuit order, who are doing, you know, the science, the astronomy, that the Vatican Observatory Research Group is all made up of Jesuit scientists. And, you know, for people who aren't familiar with this, it's a little confusing. Like, if you see Guy Consolmagno, the kind of bushy bearded guy that we interviewed in the book, and you see him in a lot of the press statements, he's the one going around at universities right now speaking about baptizing ETs and whatnot. They call him Brother Guy Consolmagno. And then other Jesuits, you will see they're called Father, blah, blah, blah. So what's the difference? A brother is to be a Jesuit, I think you have to have two PhDs, okay? So Consul Magno is a brother because he really only has like a master's level training in theology, but he has PhDs in astrophysics and things like that. So he doesn't qualify to be a father. But if you're a father, that means your main training is more in theology. Mm. So the leader of the Vorg is Jose Funes, and he's called Father Funes. And so he has a more advanced degree in theology, along with his advanced degrees in science. The brother Consul Magno is a brother because he's not a full theologian. He's mainly a scientist, and that's really his expertise. So that's the difference when you see brother and father. And so some of these Jesuits aren't really even theologians. They're actually more like secular scientists. And if you see the kind of arguments that Guy Consul Magno makes, he sounds a lot like the sorts of arguments the atheists make. I mean, like when he talks about the cosmological argument for the existence of God as if it were a, quote, God of the gaps argument, end quote. And I just made a post last week on the website. Yeah, I think even the concept of God of the gaps is circular reasoning. And the why I say that, you know, well, for people that aren't familiar, God of the gaps is something like the atheist will say that theists look at, you know, the natural realm. We look at, you know, the creation, and we say, well, you know, science can't explain this, so therefore God did it. And this is how the atheists criticize us, you know, that we put God in the gaps of scientific knowledge. So we don't understand how the origin of life happened, so we put God there. You know, that's the God of the gaps. There's a gap in scientific math.
Okay.
But see, the idea that there's a gap assumes naturalism, because it assumes one day there will be a natural explanation. So even the concept that there's a gap, I think, assumes their worldview. They don't know that it's not a supernatural thing, but they assume that one day science will explain it. Mm. So it's kind of like what I like to call promissory naturalism. We don't have an answer yet, but we promise you one day we will. So therefore, you don't need to believe in God. And that's kind of the way, you know, even the objection, you know, like, so if I say, you know, there's all this information content in DNA, you know, there's millions of strings of letters that forms this coherent pattern of information that you know helps your body to rebuild and to build. You know, it's in every cell, and the only source of information that we're aware of comes from a mind. Okay, so we're positing a mind, intelligent design, as the source of this information. Well, the atheist will come along and say, well, that's a God of the gaps argument. Well, no, it's not, because we have positive evidence that only information only comes from minds. And so when you're saying that that's a gap, you're assuming there's going to be a natural explanation. But anyway, I kind of got off the subject there, but yeah. Consul Magno, this Jesuit who's supposed to be a theist, makes the same comments. He's more of a scientist than he is a theologian, and that's kind of where I'm coming from with that.
Well, Exo Vaticana, you and Tom did a wonderful job of showing how the Jesuit order, in particular the Vatican, in general, using the research facility and the observatory there on Mount Graham to keep watch for something that as Malachi Martin told Art Bell in that famous conversation years ago, that they think something is coming that would reveal itself within the next 10 years or so. Now we've kind of fallen past that window for whatever Father Martin was talking about, but. In the new book, On the Path of the Immortals, you and Tom went back to Mount Graham, went back to that area, and found out that there was perhaps more to the location of Mount Graham than simply, you know, it being a place where the air is really dry, and so observing, you know, conditions for observing the stars were especially good there. There's probably more stuff in the air in Arizona, I would suspect, than in some of the locations a lot closer to the Vatican. They've got a lot of mountains in Europe there, you know, the Alps.
Right. Once you get up on that mountain, it's not dry anymore either. I mean, it there's a lot of moisture up there. And they found that it's not really the most ideal place. So that makes it, you know, why did they?
Exactly. That's the question.
Do an end run around, you know, every – you know, forestry service and environmental regulation. They actually had Senator John McCain just kind of did it by fiat. And by congressional mandate, they granted the permits for them to start building. you know, bypassing every environmental law and every forestry service regulation that there was. They just did it by fiat. And, you know, who else can pull something like that off? You know, when I went to Sedona, the Catholic Church has a chapel built into the Red Rocks. It's part of the National Forest up there. How did they get that done? I mean, you don't see Baptists building churches in the middle of National Forests. How does that happen? You know? But somehow the Vatican's able to pull it off, and it's always in some kind of location that has some kind of spiritual significance that they really want to get a foothold in. And what we found out about Mount Graham after the fact, mainly, a lot of the Indians believe that it really is, you know, a portal, an area where the spirit realm connects to this material realm. And we didn't really know that when we first went, when we wrote Exo Vaticana, but you know, they contacted us, you know, after we wrote the book and said, hey, you guys are really missing, you know, the boat on why we're so upset. This is one of the holiest mountains for all the indigenous tribes around the area. And, you know, we believe that this is a place where, you know, we meet, you know, the great spirit or whatnot. And so, you know, that kind of puts a change in maybe why they went up there. You know, it's hard to say because they don't talk about that sort of stuff, but, you know, that might have some explanatory power.
Hmm. The idea of the Holy Mountain, talk a little bit more about the what the natives believe about Mount Graham, but I also want to get into some of the work that you've done, which I basically ripped off for the Skywatch magazine it may issue because of something that Sharon and I read in our weekly Bible study, the account of the Israelites fleeing the Egyptians and where they crossed the Red Sea.
Right.
But the idea of this holy mountain, what is it about Mount Graham and which tribes, what do they believe in? Which tribes hold this particular mountain to be sacred?
Okay. Well, you know, as far as I know, the nearest reservation are called the West Carlos Apache, and their reservation's close by, and they definitely hold it as a sacred mountain. But according to Tom, when he talked to some of the Indians, the Navajo, the Hopi, I mean, all these people in the western United States around that area recognize that area. It's a very kind of unique mountain when you go there. I was amazed because, you know, you go through the desert of Arizona, it's nothing but like scrub brush and tumbleweeds and cactus and stuff, and it's really dry and there's nothing there. You start going up this mountain, and all of a sudden everything is plush and green, and there's ponds and trees and, you know, stuff you just don't see anywhere else in Arizona. They call it a sky island ecosystem, and this is why, you know, it's under so many environmental protections. There's animals that live on that mountain that don't exist anywhere else in Arizona. One of them is a red squirrel that they literally spent millions of dollars trying to protect. Literally, up there on Mount Graham, they have rope bridges that go over the roads for the squirrels.
Huh.
Now, I don't know how the squirrels know that they have to take the rope bridge, not where they cross the road like they always do anyway. But apparently someone convinced the state of Arizona to spend millions of dollars to build bridges for squirrels. I don't know how they're going to force the squirrels to take the bridge, though.
No, but the funny thing is my mother lives in a little community near here where they're very, very well known for being a habitat for white squirrels.
You know, okay.
White squirrels. And you can run over all the brown squirrels you want on the highways. And believe me, around here, there are a lot of them that didn't make it all the way across the road. But if you hit a white squirrel, you are fined substantially.
Wow.
So
how do you avoid that exactly?
Well, I don't know. I guess you have to make a quick judgment to see if I hit that tree, am I going to do more damage to the car than it'll cost me to just run over the squirrel? I don't know.
The red squirrel is, you know, they even try to claim that that's the only mountain in the world that particular red squirrel lives on. And, you know, there's some people that will debate that rigorously because apparently there's a lot of red squirrels in other areas that aren't that different. So.
But the point is, though, that with all the power and activism that goes into protecting animals, because we've heard stories about this, how you can't irrigate in certain areas because of, you know, in Oregon that were allowed to, you know, dry up and farmers were losing their farms because of a rare fish. And the fish was given priority over the farmers' ability to make a living. There's a lot of clout behind the ecological movement. And yet somehow the Vatican was able to circumvent that and found it important enough to make the effort to circumvent that,
yeah.
In spite of not only that opposition, but the opposition of the native tribes who held this particular mountain to be of religious significance, sacred.
Yeah, so what you asked me about earlier, I think we got off a little bit on the squirrel thing, is that, you know, what the concept of the sacred mountain and whatnot. And, of course, this is all throughout the Bible. Of course, Moses meets God on Mount Sinai, right? And, you know, you were mentioning some of the work that I've done in the past. And, yeah, you know, that was one of the early things I looked at. When I was getting a religion degree in college, I took a biblical archaeology class. And what I found out is we don't really know for sure where Mount Sinai is. There's a place that they call Mount Sinai, but there's a lot of debate. Most scholars don't think that's it. And so there's a rigorous debate going on about where exactly that is. But, you know, the main idea is that God seems to meet people up on top of mountains a lot. And why is that? You know, I don't think it's the elevation so much. I think that he really wanted Moses to get away from the other people. I think it was more the isolation, perhaps. And, you know, some of the things that God says, though, are really interesting. Like, you know, you can't, if you look at me, you're going to die, that kind of stuff.
And, right.
You know, and, you know, you get the impression, you know, when Yahweh appears like that, it's always, there's always fire or a whirlwind or lightning. You know, there's always some kind of environmental stuff going on that makes you think that, you know, he's literally somehow tearing through the laws of physics or something, you know, to violate, you know, it causes some violence in creation when God makes an appearance. You know, like when he appears to Job, it's out of a whirlwind, you know. And, you know, I found that really fascinating because, you know, in the book On the Path of the Immortals, you know, we're talking about this idea of wormholes and portals and things of that nature. And those things are, you know, usually associated with something like a whirlwind. They're associated with a vortex. A black hole is, you know, a vortex. And, you know, the scientist Roy Carr, you know, usually they thought for so long that there's no way a human could ever go through a black hole because the gravitational forces would rip you to shreds. Well, they discovered if a black hole that, you know, they, mathematically, if it's spinning at the right speed, the inertia will cancel out those gravitational forces and make it navigable. So, you know, if they were going to create a navigable, you know, a black hole that humans could go through, it would be a spinning one, in which would be what? A whirlwind, right? A vortex. And so is it just a coincidence that God took Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind? Is it just a coincidence that he speaks to Job out of the whirlwind? You know, maybe, but it also seems to match what we would expect a wormhole to look like. So I find that fascinating.
Yeah. And the concept of the portal, this is something that, you know, we've talked about off, you know, this program before, but not much here. And the possibility that Mount Graham might be a portal. First of all, how do we define that word? What do we mean when we say portal? And
it's
secondly, and second
doorway, right?
Sure. But doorway to where?
Yeah, well, that's the question, isn't it? I would say, you know, to another realm. In the Bible, we see the gates of heaven, the gates of hell. These things are in Scripture. And, you know, you get the idea that there is some kind of entry point, you know, probably more than one, to these other realms. There also seems to be somewhat of a middle ground. Paul talks about, you know, the second and third heaven, and he says that he was taken to the third heaven. He didn't know if he was in his body or not. He couldn't be sure about that. And you know, you get the idea that that's the realm, the divine realm where God is, the third heaven. In the ancient world, there was a belief that there were seven heavens, but it's not clear in Scripture that that's the case at all. But Paul does mention the third heaven. But, you know, it's clear that there are other realms, you know, heaven, hell, in minimum. You know, and hell is an ambiguous term. You know, maybe Hades is more accurate, the underworld, Sheol. I tend to relegate the term hell to the final lake of fire. And it says Hades will be thrown into the lake of fire. So, you know, I argue that really nobody's in hell right now. Mm. They're kind of in this holding area waiting for judgment after at the great white throne that's after the 1,000 years in Revelation 20. So, you know, but there are these other realms. There's Hades, the underworld, and, you know, Isaiah talks about shades, which seem to be the ghosts of human rulers who are murmuring and speaking down in Sheol. Really interesting. That's in, I think, Isaiah 14, and when it's talking about Lucifer, that famous passage in the King James where it uses the term Lucifer, but or Hillel ben Shakar in Hebrew, or Morning Star, Son of Dawn. It says that the shades will come up to greet you. Who are the shades? Well, it says they're the rulers. And where are they? In Sheol. Interesting. I think that's where Samuel was called up from in 1 Samuel 28, from Sheol. So there do seem to be ways of opening a portal and bringing someone up from Sheol. That seems to be what the medium of Endor did. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it was her power or God just allowed it, I don't know. But if you study that text, there was a belief that in a ritual pit, and it's clear that what the medium of Endor was doing is consistent with what people in the ancient Near East called a ritual pit. And they would dig a pit in the ground with the idea that somehow by their necromancy or whatever magical formulas they're using, they could call the dead up. And she falls right into the pattern of, you know, the ancient Near East by she calls him up from a pit and he shows up. And, the text represents it as Samuel. It calls him Samuel. There's no nothing in the text that would indicate it's some kind of impersonator, and mm-hmm. a lot of people try to do that because they're not comfortable with the idea of a human ghost, but nothing in the Bible supports that notion that I can see. It's pretty clear to me that the biblical author believed it was really Samuel. So that tells me that it is possible to open a portal to the underworld and have a spirit come up. So there's one example. Jacob's dream. You know, this is weird because it happens in a dream. And he dreams of a ladder with angels descending and ascending. Is that supposed to be literal? Well, Jacob seemed to think it was when he woke up because he named the place the gateway of God, the gateway to the heavens. And so Jacob believed it, and, it's in the Bible. So there's an example of a gateway to the heavens, And it's kind of interesting because it starts to beg the question, is this something that happens in a physical sense, or is it something that happens more in a spiritual, more metaphysical sense because it happened in his dream?
And furthermore, does the fact that it would happen in a sort of a dream state make it any less real?
That's right. Yeah, I don't think it does. Some dreams are obviously symbolic and whatnot, but I think there is a component to our dream life and our spiritual life that, is not physical, but it's very real.
Mm. Well, the question then, again, to come back around to the return to Mount Graham is, why was the Vatican so bound and determined to get their hands on that particular piece of property, knowing that it's not especially well-suited, not any more than a number of other locations on planet Earth, for observing the night skies, and that the local tribes with whom one presumes, and I'd have to do some research on this to confirm it, one assumes that the Jesuits, perhaps, or other Roman Catholic missionaries had been in contact with since probably the 1500s. What were they looking for, and why did they have to have that particular mountain? Or were they looking for something to come from the third heaven, or somewhere out in the sky, and to appear somewhere at Mount Graham? What's going on with that? That's the real puzzle to me.
It is. And I can't answer that. It could be as simple as it was the closest mountain to the University of Arizona. I mean, it could be that simple. But the fact that it is known as a portal area, and the Catholic Church is well known to be investigating any claim of the supernatural or anything like that, it does seem to imply that there's maybe a little more going on than the proximity of the mountain.
Hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the idea of the cosmic mountain. The thing that caught my attention and drew me to your work when I was trying to research more about this, was, again, the incident at the Red Sea, where Moses and the Israelites crossed. The verse just prior to God's command to Moses to hold up his arms and, the Red Sea would part, was not something I remember from any of the past. Any of the accounts of the story that I've heard, the Charlton Heston movie or the Sunday school stories, but just before crossing the Red Sea, God tells Moses to turn the Israelites around and go back to a place called Baal Zephon, which means Lord of the North. And Baal Zephon, or Mount Zephon, was a mountain in northern Syria. Today it's known as Mount Aqra, A-Q-R-A-A, just south of the Turkish border on the Mediterranean Sea. And that was known to the ancient Near East as the location of Baal's palace. I was not aware that Baal was also venerated in Egypt. But he was, not only as the god of storms and thunder, whatever, but also as a god of the sea and maritime navigation. So when God, you know, Yahweh, told Moses to go around and cross the Red Sea at a place that's opposite Baal Zephon, a site apparently sacred to the Canaanite god Baal, and to do so by parting the Red Sea. So not only is he in front of a site sacred to Baal, the god of maritime navigation, he's going to do this miracle with the sea to demonstrate his power over what's supposed to be Baal's domain at a site that's sacred to Baal. And that's what led me to your article on the idea that the cosmic mountain and how that translates into an ongoing struggle between Yahweh and the fallen that will culminate in the battle for God's holy mountain, the Mount of Assembly, the Har Moed as in Hebrew, or what we have what's been handed down to us through interpreters as Armageddon. What is it about the cosmic mountain, the idea that God has a holy mountain, and that his is in Old Testament scripture in numerous places described as being like but superior to other holy mountains?
Well, this is one of those areas, you know, if you don't do a lot of research and read scholarly resources and commentaries that are relatively new, you're not going to understand any of this, because a lot of this is recent discoveries in archaeology. You know, mainly we discovered a lot of clay tablets from Ugarit, the Canaanites, and we started to understand what the Canaanites believed. And then when we go back and read the Old Testament, which is in the context of Israelites being dropped in the middle of this Canaanite territory, you know, we can see that the biblical authors were addressing the beliefs of their neighbors in a polemical style, in a way, you know, to refute them. So they would say, you know, you think that Baal did this, but really Yahweh did it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they take the mythology from the Canaanites, from the Ugaritic stuff that we can now read, which no one had, you know, 100 years ago, and now we understand the context of the Old Testament so much better, because we understand, you know, the context that the Israelites were finding themselves in. And this is why, you know, sometimes just reading the Bible in isolation, you're not really going to get the context, because you have to have some kind of knowledge about the background, about the area that the Israelites were in and what their neighbors believed for it to make any sense to you. You know, for instance, you know, the famous passage I just mentioned in Isaiah 14, you know, really, was it talking about Lucifer, this fallen angel? Well, it really seems like Isaiah was drawing imagery from the Baal Athar mythology to make a point about the king of Babylon. And it could also be talking about the fall of Satan, but if so, it's more in a implied sense, you know, than, because it really seems like in the morning saw son of dawn, this is hitting on a Canaanite tradition, and it's talking about the Mount of Assembly. You know, and it says, you know, you said that you're going to put yourself on the mountain of God. This is a Canaanite myth about Athar trying to overthrow Baal. And they're saying, you know, Isaiah is taking that in a polemical fashion and using it against the king of Babylon, saying that, you know, you're just like this myth that you guys believe. And, you know, if you didn't know that, if you hadn't studied anything about, you know, Baal or the Canaanites or the Ugaritic literature, no one would ever know that. But now that we see that, it's pretty clear that that's what Isaiah was doing there. Now, I kind of think that, you know, all this mythology, you know, about Baal and Athar and, you know, Lucifer, blah, 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 I think this all does point to an underlying reality that, you know, that really could be describing the fall of Satan. But it's not, you know, it's clear to me that it, in the context of Isaiah, he was being polemical against the Canaanites. And so this is where this background stuff really comes in. Now, you know, Jerusalem, Mount Zion, is Yahweh's holy mountain now, right? And, you know, Baal had his holy mountain, but, you know, it's kind of like our God's better than your God. A lot of scripture is really like that. And you know, you don't get that unless you understand the beliefs of their neighbors. But, you know, we see this concept of a holy mountain all throughout the context of the ancient Near East. You know, even in the book of Enoch, the watchers, they come down on Mount Hermon, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And Mount Hermon was a sacred mountain to the people there. And, you know, it's not an accident that these themes appear over and over again. And again, what is it about these holy mountains? I don't think it's the elevation. I think that there
because Mount Zion is not much of a mountain, really.
No, it's not really. And, it begs the question of, you know, like the Tower of Babel.
Right.
You know, God said, well, if I allow them to build this really high tower, then they'll be able to accomplish anything they set their minds to. What was he talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Is it just that they built a tower high enough they'd be able to do anything? Well, that's obviously not the case. We have buildings way higher than what anybody could have built back then, probably now. And, you know, we haven't discovered the heavens yet. So it's not the elevation. You know, there's something more going on there. And I really think it does speak to this idea of some kind of portal, some kind of opening to the heavens that's not based on elevation at all, but something completely different.
Yeah, but
I don't understand how that technology works exactly, but there's something spiritual about it and something deeply mystical that's not entirely clear to me at this point.
No, it's clear that from the earliest days of human history, you mentioned the Tower of Babel, which in the Akkadian Bab Ilu, which essentially means God Gate,
right?
Or Gate of God,
right? And so they were trying to build a portal, to God, basically. I mean, a stairway to heaven, literally.
Right, but they didn't build. They didn't build a gate, or you know, something like like the Gateway Arch in St. Louis. Okay, there's mm-hmm. a gateway right there, but it's not necessarily a mountain. But the step pyramid shape of the ziggurat, which was the form used to build the Tower of Babel and other sacred sites in ancient Sumer, resembled a mountain. The pyramids in Egypt, the step pyramids of Mesoamerica, mm-hmm. even the mounds in North America, Cahokia and other locations. You got this idea that you need to somehow create something that resembles the shape of a mountain in order to have a place where you can commune and fellowship directly with the supernatural realm, with the gods. And that makes the Battle of Armageddon, it makes more sense to interpret that as a battle for God's holy mountain, God's Mount of Assembly, Mount Zion, rather than the Mount of Megiddo, because Megiddo is a valley. There's no mountain there.
There's no mountain in Megiddo, right?
Right. There are mountains nearby.
You're talking about the research that you're talking about that I did that you were citing it was a research paper I wrote for Old Testament 2 for Dr. Michael Heiser.
Okay.
And Mike, way back in around 2001 or something like that, he wrote a book called Islam and Armageddon.
Yes, yes.
And in that book, he cites a paper from a scholar who shows that, you know, this word that we've translated, you know, it's really interesting that, you know, in the book of Revelation, it says in Hebrew, it is, you know, Armageddon. And mm-hmm. so we have this word. It's really, in Hebrew, har is like the, mm-hmm. and, you know, Megiddo. So it's like har, you know, the mountain of God. It's kind of what it means. That's what people assume. The mountain of Megiddo, I mean,
mm-hmm.
har Megiddo. And, but what you see is that in Greek to Hebrew, when you translate, so what he's doing is he's transliterating a Hebrew word into Greek, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're taking that Greek word and translating it into English. We're not really translating it. We transliterated it as Armageddon, but it's really a Greek transliteration of a Hebrew term. But it turns out that, you know, in Greek, you can translate the ayin, which is a Hebrew letter, which doesn't really have a sound, but in Greek, they typically would translate that with a gamma, or a, you know, what we call a G, but that word is not, the letter ayin is not really pronounced in Hebrew. It's silent. So it's a very good possibility. I think it was a scholar named Torrey who who came up with this idea that it could literally, instead of Armageddon, it could be Har-Moed.
Mm-hmm.
Like M-O, like a transliteration would be M-O-E-D, something like that, which is the Mount of Assembly that you see in this passage I'm talking about, the famous Lucifer thing,
right,
in Isaiah 14. I think it's verse 13 or so. It talks about, I will sit on the Mount of Assembly. This is, you know, what Hallel ben Shakar or Lucifer is boasting. I'm going to sit on the Mount of Assembly, the Mountain of God. The Mount of Assembly is like the tent of meeting. The tent of would meet with Yahweh. It's the same sort of thing. But in, you know, the Baal mythology and the Ugaritic literature, this is the same thing, the Mount of God, the Mount of Assembly. And that's Har-Moed. So, it's, you know, it's just as possible that Armageddon means Har-Moed, Mount mm-hmm. of Assembly, than Har-Megiddo. Because there's really no mountain at Megiddo. So how can you have the Mountain of Megiddo? The only hill there is what we call a tell in archaeology. It's just a built-up layer where things have been buried over time. It's not a mountain at all. There
right.
is no Mount Megiddo. But there is a Mount of Assembly, and it makes so much more sense when you look at eschatology, when you look at passages like Zechariah 14, and the fact that Jesus, you know, when he returns at the Battle of Armageddon, that's going to be on the Mount of Olives, which is right next to Mount Zion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
yeah.
so it's right there. And so I think that's what's going on. I think Armageddon is really a battle for the cosmic mountain, for the holy mountain. It doesn't have anything to do with the plain of Megiddo necessarily.
And you mentioned Isaiah 14, 13, and this is a really intriguing verse for a couple of reasons. That is, in fact, where Isaiah quotes the character that he's referring to, whether it's the king of Babylon or Lucifer, Hallel ben Shakar. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the Mount of Assembly, Har-Moed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the ESV translates it as in the far reaches of the north.
Right.
But the NIV translates it as on Mount Zaphon, which brings us back
right.
to Baal Zaphon.
Uh-huh.
And a reference to the location of the palace of Baal. So, Isaiah, there in chapter 14, on the utmost heights of Mount Zaphon is how the NIV translators chose to render that particular verse. Just makes that episode with Moses on the shore of the Red Sea even more intriguing, because it's clear now there was more going on in that confrontation than just God delivering the Israelites from the hand of Pharaoh and the most potent military force in the ancient Near East of that day. Yeah, that was part of it, but it was also part of a, you know, the closest example I can think of was the famous, you know, called shot of Babe Ruth in the, 1938 World Series. Maybe I got the wrong year, but anyway, where he points to center field at Wrigley Field, and then the next pitch hits it over the center field wall. It's like Yahweh saying to Baal and all of, you know, the rest of the fallen watchers, see, here, this is what I'm going to do, you know, in front of a site sacred to you and in an area where you're supposed to be dominant. I'm going to demonstrate my power, complete of power and authority over you right here. And it's going to culminate. It's going to culminate at Har-Moed, the Mount of Assembly, in the final battle between Yahweh, led by Jesus on his return, and the forces of Antichrist. To me, that is just so compelling and powerful. And again, it just makes the whole biblical narrative just so much more cohesive in terms of the spiritual war that is playing out, and in which we're just taking such a very small part right now. It almost, you know, gives me goosebumps just thinking about this.
Yeah, exactly. And that word Zaphon in Hebrew, it literally translates to north.
Yes.
And you know, so it says, I will sit on the Mount Assembly on the summit of Zaphon, or in the far reaches of the north. You know, scholars are trying to make sense of that. I think either way is okay. But I think one thing that people probably miss out on, and, you know, I know that you're aware of this, and scholars have written about it, but this concept of the north, you know, is it just talking about the direction north on a compass? Well, in the ancient world, it seems to be a little more than that. There's this idea of the cosmic north. So it's a little more than, you know, the northern direction from Israel, you know, which would be Turkey or Russia or mm-hmm. something like that. It's talking about the far north, and it might be vertical, you know, into the atmosphere, the cosmic north. And it's, a lot of times that's what they meant. They didn't really mean our neighbors to the north. They meant the heavenlies. They meant, mm-hmm. you know, God, the realm, the divine realm, the realm of the gods, you know. And so a lot of times when they say the far reaches of the north, it's something much bigger than, you know, their geographics.
Yeah. Well, regardless of what we're talking about or which prophecies we're looking at, I mean, in a spiritual sense and also in a very, you know, literal naturalistic sense, the enemies of Israel, God's chosen people, generally came from the north because that was the most the easiest
sure.
path of travel for armies coming from the north. But if we're talking about the cosmic north, Mount Zifan, the Palace of Baal, or the Fallen Watchers, either way makes sense prophetically as we look at the Gog Magog prophecy of Ezekiel 38.
Right.
And of course, the final confrontation at Har Moed, Mount Zion.
Right.
Things are getting interesting in the prophetic realm. And apparently the Vatican, again, looking for something out there that they may identify as extraterrestrial.
Coming from the far reaches of the north.
Coming from the far reaches of the cosmic north, exactly. So that's how I'm
right.
trying to tie this all together. And Chris, again, your work has been, you know, the research that you and Tom have collaborated on over the last few years on these books. I know you've caught a lot of flack. I mean, and it's almost comical to me to see first the people who criticize you as being Catholic bashers for simply reporting on what members of the Jesuit order and members of the Vatican staff have themselves said. But then on the other side of the coin, being criticized as a Jesuit coadjutor and apologist
yeah.
for the Vatican.
For promoting Catholic prophecies. Yeah, there you go.
Exactly, for the Petrus Romanus. So you must be doing something right if you're catching it from both sides. And
That's the way I tend to look at it. You know, if you're not ticking people off, you're probably too worldly. But you know, I get it from both sides, like you said, from the Catholics who don't like that we're critical of Catholic traditions and Catholic theology, and even the whole concept of the papacy. You know, I just don't think any of that isn't consistent with the Bible at all.
Right, right.
And you know, I point that out historically. I think the Book of Acts will refute the idea that Peter was a pope. I mean, you know, the whole first half of the book is Peter, and then the second half of the book is Paul in the Book of Acts. And the end of the book, where does it end? Paul is where? He's in Rome, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's in prison. He, you know, and does it mention Peter? No. But at the time, the Catholic Church would have Peter as the Bishop of Rome. You know, by
right.
the time the Book of Acts ends, Peter should have been Bishop of Rome according to their story.
Mm-hmm.
But why is that never mentioned? You know, where's Peter in the end of the Book of Acts? And then why in the Book of Romans does Paul send a list of greetings to like 28 people and he never mentions Peter? Because I guess because Peter wasn't in Rome. But,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
if you believe the Catholics, he would have to be. So it's the New Testament itself counts against the idea that Peter was ever a pope. And if Peter was never a pope, then the whole concept of apostolic succession that they based their authority on just caves right in like a house of cards.
Yeah.
And, you know, for that reason, I just can't accept it.
Well, you're just controlled opposition, Chris. That's the truth.
I know.
The new book co-authored with Tom Horn is On the Path of the Immortals, but Chris's former previous books, Exo Vaticana and Petrus Romanus, also co-authored with Tom Horn. But his book, The Supernatural Worldview, an important book for your reference library. If you don't have a copy already, get a copy of The Supernatural Worldview, if nothing else. Chris, always a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to seeing you face-to-face again soon. Say hi to Shelley for us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Derek. It's great to talk to you again.
I'll put a link in the show notes to Chris's website, logosapologia.com, .org. It's .org. And also to where you can get a copy of the book, On the Path of the Immortals. That is the new book co-authored with Tom Horn. And if you pay attention to what we've been doing at Skywatch TV at all, of course, you are fully aware that that book is now available. And but I'll put a link in the show notes just in case. Couple of notes just on things that have happened this week. Last weekend in May, was the big contact in the desert conference, big UFO conference out in the high desert of California, Joshua Tree, California, featured a who's who of the ancient alien paradigm, Giorgio Tsakalos, David Wilcock, Eric Von Daniken, of course. And I know I'm leaving out one of the speakers inadvertently, but anyway, there were a number there. It was described as the Woodstock of UFO conferences, and based on the speaker list, I can see why they would say that. George Noory of Coast to Coast AM was there as a special host. Astronauts Story, Musgrave, and Edgar Mitchell, who appeared by Skype video, were also there. Edgar Mitchell's in his 80s now, and his health is not good, but they were there. Top-notch conspiracy investigators like Jim Mars, Peter LaVenda. But the overall theme of the conference was essentially, you know, we take the extraterrestrial presence on Earth as a given. You know, let's not even discuss the technological challenges that might prevent a civilization from getting from somewhere across the galaxy to planet Earth, or why they would even want to expend the kind of energy. I mean, you know, think about it. We on planet Earth haven't been able to afford, or so the reasoning goes, we've not been able to afford to send a manned mission to the moon in 40 years, more than 40 years. We're talking about a manned mission to Mars, but I'll believe that when I see it. But we haven't gone back to the moon in 40 years. And yet we're supposed to just take it as a given that somehow ET has been able to afford to send a manned craft, or a, you know, you know, using the word manned kind of loosely, across the galaxy. Somehow been able to marshal together the resources needed, the energy, the food, the water, or whatever else might sustain life over the course of a journey, and send it all the way across the galaxy to visit this relatively insignificant planet, at least in the eyes of the ancient astronaut, you know, evangelists, for the purpose of what? To be really sneaky about whether or not they've actually been here, rather than coming forward and saying, hey, you know, we've expended all of this, whatever their quote, all these quatloos in order to travel across the galaxy. Here we are. Not really much of that. Although Stanton Friedman was there, nuclear physicist, who's a well-known ufologist, and he did talk about some of the scientific challenges that would face a manned mission. But aside from his presentation and one or two others, the vast majority of the presentations at Contact in the Desert were devoted to the big questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? Where do we go when we die? And the press conference, or the press coverage, quoted a number of attendees who said that that was exactly why they were there. I've been looking for these answers all my life, and that's why I've traveled from Colorado or from Washington State here to California to find these answers. And sadly, those are the answers that they should be getting from between the covers of their Bible. But for whatever reason, they have rejected the gospel message. They've rejected the truth claims of Christianity and are searching for it in an alien gospel, which is why Guy Malone's Ancient of Days conferences down in Roswell, New Mexico, were so important. If you have not seen the presentations from the Ancient of Days conferences, which Guy put on for about 4 years, if I remember correctly, and had top-notch Christian presentations, as well as some non-Christian presenters, those were so important. And that's why it's Skywatch TV. And here on A View from the Bunker and PID Radio, Sharon and I will talk about this topic on a regular basis. Because statistically speaking, if the surveys that I've read are accurate, and these were conducted by fairly large organizations, National Geographic for one, the Barna Group for another, the odds are, or at least the statistics show, that adults in America are about 8 times more likely to consider the possibility that ET has visited Earth, and about 4 times more likely to absolutely believe that ET has visited the Earth than to believe in the God of the Bible, to have a biblical worldview, to believe that Jesus lived a sinless life, died an atoning death on the cross, was literally resurrected from the dead, that Satan is a force or an entity and not just a concept, You know, to accept some of the basic tenets of Christianity, there are four times more adults in the United States who believe that E.T. is visiting Earth, and about eight times more who are at least open to the possibilities, willing to concede that evidence suggests that we may be hosting visitors from another planet, than are people who are willing to accept God as he's revealed himself to us in the Bible. And that, I believe, is tragic. And it's really sad when you read these quotes in USA Today or wherever from people who will travel hundreds and hundreds of miles hoping and in desperately hoping to find answers from these evangelists of the ancient alien gospel. A couple of other news items. Of course, Dr. Ray Kurzweil in the news again this week. He addressed a financial conference in New York and predicted that humans will be hybrids by 2030, that we will be a blend of biology and technology, that our brains will be connected directly to the cloud via nanotechnology that will be constructed from DNA. So we got that to look forward to, as if I don't spend enough time online. Egg rationing has already begun in the United States. Reports coming from Texas that some grocery chains down there, at least one grocery chain down there, is announcing that eggs are not available for commercial sale. In other words, bakeries cannot go to a grocery store and buy up all the eggs they want. They're limiting egg sales to 3 cartons per customer. And this is because of the avian flu outbreak, the H5N2 outbreak that has now required the euthanasia of over 30 million chickens, mainly in Iowa, which is the number one egg-producing state in the country. But it's affecting a number of states from Washington to Kentucky, and not just affecting chicken operations, but also turkey operations as well. When you add in the turkeys, it's I think we're close to 50 million birds have been put down, and it showed up in wild fowl flocks, geese, ducks, in states like Wisconsin and Minnesota. So that is something that is really worth keeping an eye on. Meanwhile, speaking of pestilence, the MERS outbreak continues in South Korea. Over 1,000 schools were closed, and this was as of the last time I checked, which was about Thursday of this past week. At that time, there were 35 confirmed cases, 3 deaths. The thing that's scary about MERS is that the disease in the past has not shown itself to be easily transmissible. And in the case of the third fatality in South Korea, the victim was only in the presence of the first victim, the first patient, for about 5 minutes and was not in close contact with that person. So clearly it is transmissible through the air, does not require close contact. And the mortality rate of MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, a coronavirus, is about 40%. So Korea is really taking this very, very seriously. Again, even though there's only about 36 confirmed cases as of Thursday this week and 3 deaths, it is something that is very, very worrying at this point. You may not have heard about this story. This was a little bit weird. Came out of Minneapolis. A group of middle and high school-aged students were taken on a field trip without prior knowledge to the parents, according to the news story, to an adult novelty store. The director of the Gaia Democratic School, and you'd think the name would be a bit of a tip-off right there, took them to a place called the Smitten Kitten. And parents were a bit upset that they weren't given any advance notice or an opportunity to opt out of this particular field trip. The director of the school said she thought it was beautiful because kids could talk to sex educators without any shame, without any fear. But following the reaction of parents, who again should have wondered what they were getting into when they signed their children up for a private school called the Gaia Democratic School. Democratic not because of the political party, but because children play an active role in determining what they are going to learn in school each day. And according to a video I saw of the director, one of their classes is being taught by an 11-year-old student. Their class in compassion being taught by an 11-year-old. But anyway, the director said that this will probably be the last time we take this kind of field trip. First time we took it, it'll probably be the last time, which she said was too bad, and I quote, because the kids had so much fun, end quote. And all you can say is, yeah, I just bet they did. And in England, the Church of Laodicea taking deeper root there as a feminist group called Women and the Church, or WATCH, is advocating through a media campaign for the Church of England to refer to God as she. You see, because referring to God in with male pronoun, which the Bible does. In fact, Jesus prayed to the Father, and the apostles taught us to pray in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. But apparently doing that, according to the Women of WATCH, is sexist. It creates an incomplete understanding of what or who God is, and also gives the impression that men are somehow closer to God than women. Which, to be fair, is a belief that was propagated by some, has been propagated by some in the church over the centuries, but is not scriptural. As the Apostle Paul wrote, there's neither slave nor free, male nor female, Jew nor Greek, because we are all one in Christ Jesus. That being said, the Women of WATCH have decided that they're going to, you know, after having won the victory last year to push the Church of England into ordaining female bishops, now to actually change the gender by which we refer to God the Father. Well, you know, when you start down that path and you begin to allow your feelings to dictate your theology, pretty much anything is fair game. And what you wind up with is a God who looks like the face in your mirror. I've seen the face in my mirror, and I have no confidence whatsoever of him being able to run anything larger than his household, and even that is kind of shaky at times. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, we made a change this week. Rather than broadcasting live or webcasting live, as we'd been doing since we began, we have shifted it to a podcast only. And the reason for doing that is essentially this. We're living out in the country now. We don't have cable internet anymore. We can only get satellite internet service, and there is a lag. There is a lag between the send and the receive. So the interface with Blog Talk Radio was really poor last week. It was impossible to listen to, and I apologize to those who did struggle through and listen to the entire hour as we streamed it live, because it was really difficult to listen to when I heard the recorded version. So we will record these and upload these for Sunday mornings from here on out, or at least until such time as our remote rural area here in the Ozarks gets cable internet, or God willing, fiber optic internet. But we're not going to hold our breaths waiting for either one of those. The cables, I mean, the internet service really isn't bad. We're actually fairly pleasantly surprised by the speed of the internet. It's just that we have a data cap that we didn't have with cable internet. When we had cable internet, we didn't have any cable TV because we watched everything off of Netflix, Hulu Plus, and Amazon Prime. So we were probably burning through 300, 350 gigabytes of data a month on our internet plan. And because we lived in a college town previously, we had internet service that was 105 megabit per second download speed. So we were really spoiled. Right now we've got a 10 gig data cap, 50 available bonus gigs if we use it between 2 and 8 in the morning. So anything we have to do, like updating software on a computer, we just get up early and do it before 8 a.m. But it does put a limit on what we can do. So no more streaming from Netflix for us. Everything has to be live. But so far, at least the connection for getting on and checking email and updating things via Facebook and Twitter has been no problem at all. But going forth, the Gilbert House Fellowship will be available at gilberthouse.org Sunday morning, usually by mid-morning or so. And today we covered Leviticus chapters 4 through 8. Very precise and specific instructions from God on what was to be done with the blood from the sacrifices, and differences between different types of sacrifices, the peace offering, the sin offering, the ordaining, you know, the offering for ordainment of the priest, very specific things. It's to be frank with you, it's the boring section of the Bible to read through, to be quite honest, but you know, you have to believe that God doesn't put anything in his word that he didn't consider important. There are reasons for all of those rules that are there. And if nothing else, when you go through that and you understand that God was It helps you understand a couple of things. First of all, how serious the problem of sin is that you require such specific and detailed instructions and the shedding of so much blood for atonement. That's point number one. And point number two is praise God and thank God that we don't have to do that anymore because of the once for all perfect sacrifice of Jesus on the cross. So that was our discussion this morning. If you missed it and would like to catch it in the archives, all of the episodes are archived for free at gilberthouse.org. This Tuesday night, SkyWatch TV airs again, 8:30 p.m. Central Time. That's UTC-5 on the Christian Television Network. That is DirecTV Channel 376, Dish Network Channel 267, and Glory Star Satellite Channel 117 as well. Follows our friends at Prophecy Watchers on the Christian Television Network. It also streams live at ctnonline.com. I've been producing a daily news update of about 5 to 10 minutes in length every day, Monday through Friday, that is, every weekday. Generally try to have it uploaded to the internet by about 2 in the afternoon. Depends on what else is going on that day, but you'll catch that at skywatchtv.com. It will also be posted to the official YouTube channel for SkyWatch TV. And if you have a Roku device, you can add the SkyWatch TV Roku channel to your account and then watch those on demand, as well as the SkyWatch TV programs. And instructions on how to add the Roku channel to your Roku account are at skywatchtv.com/Roku. A View from the Bunker is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and various other podcatching and podcast aggregating websites around the internet, and appreciate your reviews and your feedback. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin McLeod. His website is incompetech.com. And we do this because we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert. This is A View from the Bunker.